Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
We're going old school this week on the Real Guy Podcast.
My father was a bicycle letter carrier for Las Olas and Cordova Road.
The legendary Mark Croca.
Netting mullet is an athletic event. It should be in the Olympic.
We get into some real guy talk.
Jimmy, what do you do when somebody just cuts your balls off and gets right in front of you on a spot?
His recollections of guides that came before him.
I got to, the first time I met Bill Curtis was at the ramp at Crandon in the 70s. And he stopped and talked. He was kind of a little bit grumpy.
And how he remembers the mullet run.
And it was a dark stripe that was 100 feet wide along the beach, as far as you could see both ways. And every 150 feet or 200 feet, there was a massive shower of either tarpon or black tips or whatever the hell else was under that much bait back then. There were not thousands of mullet. There weren't millions. There was probably billions.
A little gospel from the most victorious inshore tournament guide that the Keys has ever seen.
You can't lay back. You can't sit back and say, hey, I know enough, because you don't. No. You don't know enough, and you never will. Nobody ever will.
All this week on the Real Guy Podcast.
Clear the airwaves. The Lunker Dog is on the air.
Are you ready? This is the Real Guy Podcast.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Real Guy Podcast. Today is a very special day because we are down in Island Mirada, and we were with one of the world's greatest fishermen and one of the biggest influences on my life, Mark Croca. Thanks for being on the Real Guy Podcast. And we have your world favorite, Captain Norms, here with us today. And Norm and Mark have had some history.
Yeah.
Over the years. And why don't we start with that? Norm, how did you get to know Mark?
Well, Water Taxi had its office above the Lauderdale Marina Dock Store back in the, this was 1980s, late 1980s, 89, 90. And Mark was guiding out of Lauderdale Marina back then. And Dad started fishing with Mark before I met Mark. And he was doing the tarpon thing, doing what you do, Jeff.
Right.
And then we fished, gosh, how many years did we fish together? Many.
Still do.
Many, still do. Yeah, it's been a little bit yet. It was Dad probably fished with Mark more than I did.
So your father,
over the years.
So your father had their fishing relationship with Mark.
Yeah, well, we both did, but that was basically, and Dad absolutely loved Mark.
Well, I loved him too, and he was more than a fishing buddy. He was my friend too, one of my Lauderdale friends.
Yeah, and
for sure.
Yep, and but boy, we had some great times. Dad was probably not one of the greatest casters in the world. I guess I do best by example, and I told this tale at Dad's funeral when Dad passed away. We were fishing on the outside of Elliott, I think it was, on the ocean side, and Mark was pulling us down this flat, and Mark calls the shot. There he is, 1 o'clock. 30 feet or 40 feet, fire now. And, you know, you got to make that shot right as he calls it, otherwise it's done. And Dad picks up the rod, fires at 9 o'clock at 50 feet. Mark says, you blew that shot, Norm, fire. And the next thing we know, Dad says, are you sure I blew that shot? And he's hooked up.
I remember now.
Okay. Mark didn't see the fish. I didn't see the fish. Dad swears up and down, and he took it to his grave, that he absolutely saw that fish and made
that
cast.
There's no way he did. There's no way. And nobody would lie all the way to their grave either. There's no way. But you know what? It's hard to argue with what happened.
I know. And, it was, and we caught that fish. It was a nice fish.
We did. I
remember. Oh, man.
See, that summarizes the whole thing. It's like you fish with people and immediately you develop a relationship that's different. I mean, you can play golf, you can go bar hopping, you can chase women, you can do a lot of things. But when you spend that kind of quality time with somebody, the relationship is different. You know what I mean?
There's no doubt of that. You're 8 hours and you're close. You're so close that you either come off of the boat at the end of the first time with someone loving them or never wanting to see them again. And
right.
Thankfully, in our business, 999 times out of 1,000, a person who's in the boat is there for the same reasons you are, because of their love for everything that's outside of the boat when you're on the water. And you can't help but hit it off.
In fact, it's probably one of the few, I don't want to use the term client customer, you know, relationship, but it's kind of what it is, where it's actually one of the very few instances where even if you hate that person, you might still go back because they're so good at what they do.
For sure.
Like, I mean, I know a lot of people that I despise fishing with, but I'll fish with them over and over and over again because they are that good at it. And I know that there's lots of people that are like that. Fortunately, Mark is not one of those guys. Mark is a lot of fun to fish with.
Thanks for clearing that up. and just one little quick note about your father that I wanted to put in, and I told you about this, of course, back during a time when I was going through some tough times in my life. It was your dad that pulled me aside and said, come on, I'm taking you out to lunch. I want you to, let's talk about what's going on. And he was not only, again, not only someone that I just fished with, but he was a friend, and he was a reciprocal friend. He was very important, and I appreciate that. I have always appreciated that. So thank you, and thank him.
Oh yeah, it's you know, any time you know, there's just some people in your life that are, you know, you might not see them for a year, but they're still just that important. You know,
and he made me mad. The one thing about your dad that made me really angry all the time, we would be out in the boat, and he would see a boat halfway out in the Gulf Stream and say, oh, that's a Trumpy, you know, 1934 built, a 64-foot Trumpy. I'm like, how in the hell can you see that? And it was a Trumpy, and it was a 64-foot Trumpy. And not only that, most of the time, most of the boats that came by, especially in Fort Lauderdale, he would tell you the owner, where it's docked, and it was unnerving.
It really was.
And I threw the bullshit flag on him a few times, and it wasn't bullshit.
No.
He knew.
Yep. And you couldn't call him out on it because he'd just smoke you. And it was he had a photographic memory.
Yeah, he did.
Absolutely photographic memory. He could remember somebody from 30 years ago that he met one time, and he'd tell you all about that experience.
Sure.
That person.
I don't think you knew this or remember this, but we went to some committee meeting, a public hearing for the right to fish in the hot water canal. And you know who sat next to me? Your dad.
No kidding.
Your dad was the biggest voice. And do you remember a guy who had barges named Grady?
Yeah, John Grady.
That's correct. That's correct. He was there. But it was your dad. Your dad and I sat together at those hearings, and we fought for the right to fish in the, of all places, the hot water discharge. Like, it was the manatee issue. They had painted a picture. I don't mean to take a left turn here in the conversation.
No, go ahead. Have at it.
But they wanted to keep everybody out of there. They wanted to stop all fishing. They thought that we were throwing treble hook mirror lures in the manatee's eyeballs. And listen, they're endangered, and we respect them, and we educate when we're out. We educate people who are in the boat about them. But we actually had to fight for the right to fish in the part of the canal that remained open, not even the entire canal.
And they've succeeded in that.
Well, they have now, but now there's no hot water coming out of there on a regular basis.
There's no reason to go there.
It's a moot point. It doesn't matter. Yeah. Right. But back then, this was back in I want to say the late 80s or early 90s when that place was still productive. So your dad, you know, again, kudos to him.
Yeah.
He was instrumental in us being able to still fish there.
And that's the difference between, you know, we Fort Lauderdale was a marine community at one time. It's no longer a marine community.
Oh, I'm sad
to hear that. It really is not. It's become very corporate, foreign-owned, the development, and that's something that Jeff will talk about. But, I mean, that's one of the reasons we wanted to come down here and talk to you, because we wanted you to give us a taste of what it was like guiding back when you started. And
I want Mark to understand that what you guys were doing fighting to be able to fish in the hot water canal. I got friendly with Steve Kantner and Carl Ball and a list of other guys because they wanted to close down the fishing on the beach in Fort Lauderdale.
Mm-hmm.
And we rallied together, and I mean literally had hundreds of people to show up for this hearing. And we got it squashed very quickly. But the reason I bring that up is, to this day, fishermen will come together to fight for the right to simply fish.
And it's sad that they have to.
Well, you have to. And I think what's eye-opening is this is nothing new.
No.
They were doing it. When was that, Mark?
That was 80s, early 90s probably. Yeah.
Yep. Okay.
And I'm sure there was fishermen that got together for other places even before that. So with all the gossip that goes around and all the headbutting that happens amongst fishermen, and especially in the professional circuit, there's a time where we come together and we fight for what's right. And it's still going on today. And I think that's what separates your average outdoorsman or your average fisherman from the actual real guy that has some spirit in it and wants that spirit to live on.
Well, that to your point, Jeff, that's a great observation. It goes above and beyond if someone's a Democrat or Republican, a man or a woman, whatever all that horse shit has been coming to. If you're aimed for that goal of just being able to fish, that's all we want to do. Mm-hmm. And most of that is catch and release anyway.
Right.
The stuff that you're fishing for on the beach, for the most part, the stuff we were doing in the discharge canal or the port, with the exception of some of the snook, but the snook are so heavily regulated now that at least down here in Southwest Florida, the park and the Keys, you have to be a magician to catch a slot snook. You're going to catch plenty of 23-inchers and then some, you know, 18 and 19-pounders, but, you know, go try to catch a 29-incher and in season.
Right.
And in the right, whatever those zones are, there's different zones now.
You have to
either be an attorney or hire one to understand what you can do and when you can do it. The trout thing, it's all become so complicated. And again, Jeff, like you said, we just want to go fishing. We just want to fish. That's all.
Right.
That's all.
And I think it's important for all of us for that spirit of fishing to live on amongst the young people. Like we were talking about Zach Routman early, and to see a young guy understand the fishery, you know that he has the spirit to carry on. And I think that's a big deal. But talking about big snooks, Mark, almost everybody that I've ever interviewed that came out of the, I call it the tree of Fort Lauderdale. You know, we have a tree and fishermen grow on it. And then they fall on the ground. Some of them live on to be other trees. But the reason I bring that up is all the people that I've ever interviewed, old schoolers, Tommy Green, George Copeland, I mean, the list goes on and on and on. We were all started, and we focused on giant lunker snooks. Was that hold true with you also?
There's no doubt. I mean, maybe prior to that, we all started with bass because it was accessible, and we could ride our bikes there, and you could be fishing. You didn't have to have a boat. You didn't have to have a car. We were kids. We all did it. We all got on the bike and went where we could go. But definitely the snook was more mysterious. The snook was that next level that you graduated to, you know, maybe after even the crevalle. We could all catch crevalle, same thing from the bikes. But the snook, you had to have bait. You had to have You didn't have to. You could do it with mirror lures or soft plastics, but standing on a bridge, I still tell everybody, the most physical thing I ever did in my life was catching gigantic snook off little bridges.
Oh, absolutely.
We had the, I don't know if you remember the old archer's hard leather forearm guards. And that's what I used to wear because after...
Railed.
Oh, my. Railed is the word. And
yeah.
Concreted because a lot of the bridges didn't have aluminum railings. They just were concrete. And some of the worst injuries I ever had, you know, abrasion-wise, were getting nailed by big snook. And you had to use 80 or 100-pound line. Of course, now with braid brings a whole other level to that. But you're right. Back in the day, the first thing I did when I got my driver's license was we had access to all those places by vehicle. And you could park back then right on top of the bridges and fish, you know, every quadrant of the bridge, swing your mullet under or swing your big Mahara under and catch one or not catch one, move on to the next place where you had to be tide wise. And we had a whole group, you know, we talked about Howard Brennan, the old the retired Jersey cop that fished Hendricks Isle Bridge all the time. Well, he also fished, what was the bridge by 17th Street? The Mercedes Bridge.
Yes.
The Mercedes Bridge. You used to be able to park up on the berm up next to that. And I saw him one day. He was loading a 21-pound snook in his trunk, and he had his driver's side car door open. He had it was a Delta 88 or a Cutlass 88. What color was it again? It was green
opaque blue.
It was like teal, whatever the color whatever was, was disgusting. It was just like you would never paint a car that. But anyway, a guy, this is at 3:30 in the morning, a guy going eastbound smashes off the railing of the bridge and just narrowly missed Howard, who was standing at his trunk of his car, and took his driver's door completely off of the vehicle.
Oh, my.
And he went off of the thing and over by Church by the Sea.
Yeah.
And did a one tumble and was there. And we went down, and he was okay. He was drunk. And they got him, and, you know, they arrested him. But you're standing on the bridge, you know, in 1 second, everything is peaceful. Howard, that's a great snook, you know. And then all of a sudden, here's a drunk coming. Boom, 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 boom. And you know, things like that used to happen at the bridges all the time. Sunrise Boulevard Bridge. I was standing with my father when I was about 6 or 7 years old, and we were leaned over the bridge on the north side of Sunrise Bridge, and you got Birch State Park to your right and the fire station there, and there's just 300 snook sitting under us in the current, and we're catching them on jigs, and there was a guy next to my father who was next to me, and some kids coming from the beach, again, you know, midnight, 1 in the morning.
Right.
Every snook story is in the dark. Every good snook story is in the dark. And they threw a full bottle of beer, and the guy standing next to my dad took it in the side of his head, and we had to take him to Broward General.
Oh.
And he got, you know, the whole side of his head was stitched up, but we actually put him in the car and took him in. So
was Beefsteak Charlie's there?
Beefsteak Charlie's was on the... That was also on the north side of the bridge on the left.
And the Careless Navigator.
Oh, my God.
Right. Oh,
so, wow.
So this is... So
Beefsteak Charlie's, $5.95, all the shrimp you could peel and eat.
That's right.
Yep.
And we would... I still fish there to this day. I'll fish right behind there. And I tell people, because that's a mega yacht marina now.
Yeah.
And I mean the finest mega yacht marina ever built. And I used to tell people that this was used to be an alley. And we'd sit in this alley with our bicycles, and we'd fish. And the stench that came from Beefsteak Charlie's.
The old beer.
They had all-you-could-eat shrimp, so there was always
Shrimp I remember
in there.
That.
And we would fish in that stench back there on a hot summer night. And you could just hear the snooks all the way down the canal.
Popping,
Boom, boom, boom.
Yep.
You know, my wife's business is right there.
Really?
Beefsteak Charlie's, the same soil Beefsteak Charlie's was on.
That's now, amazing.
She's in the bottom of that Sunrise Harbor, and I took my little girl there, and we go up to the bridge, and you can still, there's only two or three snooks hanging there now.
Right.
But they still want to be there after all these years.
That's amazing. Yeah. Also, at that bridge back in the 60s, we caught 3 and 4 pound trout, and my father caught a redfish there once, and also we caught black drum under that bridge.
Trout.
10, 11, and 12 pound.
Trout.
That's right. Speckled trout. And
speckled
trout. And you know Seven Bridges?
Sure, yeah.
You know where Seven Bridges? Dad used to catch, My father was a bicycle letter carrier for Las Olas and Cordova Road,
mm-hmm.
way back. I mean, back when they delivered mail on bicycles. So that's how far back it was. And he caught redfish and black drum on those bridges, at Seven Bridges. That's how long ago he was fishing there. Back when Cliff Lake was attached
sure.
to the other canals via a culvert.
Mm-hmm.
Cliff Lake had tarpon and snook in it.
Yep. Yeah, we still go back to some of the old haunts. The fish want to be there, Mark.
Isn't it weird that they go back to, and they do it down here, the same places we fished our whole life. That's they want to be at those places. There's something about, we call them red zones.
I don't know, like it's like a salmon or a trout in freshwater. It's like they can't help it. Their DNA makes them want to go back there.
It's
in the back of the river, Mark. Is the water's fresh, full of duckweed now. There's mega yachts everywhere. Pollution's rampant. But on any given day, you can go back there by Marina Bay or West, and the thing is slapped full of tarpon. Now, they may only last a day or two.
Right.
But something makes them want to go back.
Offshore is the same way. Mm-hmm. Offshore, any given time of the year, there's just certain places that are, like you said, Mark, they're just red zones. And they always, it's just one of those places you're always going to check.
Right. And then you're talking about having to go back. There's a rumor in my family amongst my parents that I was conceived on the catwalk of the 7 Mile Bridge, so I've moved back to the Keys. So I guess I'm just going to keep
DNA.
Moving. Yeah, that's right.
And people want to know why he's got the upper edge on everybody.
So maybe that's true.
Speaking of having the upper edge on everybody, do you know how many of these tournaments that you've won down here in the Keys over the years?
I do not know. Marcy, my official better three-quarters and statistician extraordinaire would be able to tell you that. But no, I do not know. I do not know.
It's got to be just from – let's just try to paint a picture. We're sitting
hey,
in –
that's funny, paint a picture.
Yeah,
I get
well,
it.
Well, we
very
are –
very good.
We are sitting in Mark's kitchen, and we're sitting at a table, and the entirety of the house – has these beautiful artist rendering of just all kinds of fish, mostly backcountry. If you were to put together an art gallery, it would look like the inside of Mark's house. However, each one of these pictures has a placard on it, which represents a trophy, which was a tournament win and or placing. There's got to be at least 100 of these that are visible to the eye.
Well, Marcy was nice enough to show us around a little bit, and she opened up a few closets and stuff, and there's just stacks
of them in the closets.
Stacks of them.
Well,
no, go ahead.
So those things are great, but the fishery down here is mostly sight fishing, and you can get fortunate enough. Some people have been fortunate enough to have one or two really great anglers to fish these events with, and you develop a teamwork,
mm-hmm.
and it's like a doubles team in tennis. It's an engine in a car. If all six cylinders are working, the engine works good. If four of them aren't working too well, the engine doesn't work too good. So I've been lucky enough to have probably more than my share of really, really good anglers who have taken their game home and become really, really great casters. And I truly believe that when you go out fishing in a tournament, that most everybody in those events is having, give or take a few shots, about the same number of shots at whatever the target mm-hmm. species are in that tournament. And the competition's that good. I mean, everybody knows their shit. And the guys that have come out in the boat over the years who have taken it to the next level have all done their homework. They've all gone home and practiced cast. A couple of guys that come to mind, I mean, just a few of the guys that I fish with who have gotten to that level. You got Dan Zuccari, Cal Blumberg, Frank DeLucas, Mo Smith, Tim Mahaffey. I'm neglecting some somewhere. Rich Barnett, the young guy. Who's the Apache helicopter pilot? All of these guys have gone home and practiced and sharpened their knife.
Right.
And all I have to do is find something, and then they do the rest.
Right.
So a lot of it is on them. A lot of it is on them. If you can't do that, we don't catch the fish.
Yeah. And that's a great analogy about all the pistons firing on a well-oiled engine. It's not just about that, but it's about the communication and what you know about the other angler and the chemistry and everything else like that, which would probably make my fishing and Dad's fishing with you, that would have equated to about a 1965 Chevrolet Corvair.
Which, by the way, is a collector's item.
We were like watching monkeys using tools for the first time.
I don't think monkeys using tools was the analogy you were trying to convey there, but monkeys doing something.
So basically what you're saying is you're not a magician. You're more like a head football coach that has had the players that would put in the time and the energy to make it happen.
There's no doubt. No doubt.
Well, that's refreshing because, a lot of guys in your position would pat themselves on the back and they would say, I or me, or I did this or I did that. And anybody that's ever played any type of real sport and has competed at a level realizes that there's very little I's and me's involved.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, I would do this. I would shake all of their hands, all the gentlemen who were on the bow of the boat who made this possible. It's an intersection for them. It's an intersection of time and finances and willingness and drive and execution. And sometimes that happens to someone for a year or 2 years, and then there's other rare cases where, I don't know if you guys have heard of Jim Boker, but Boker was on top of his game for a few decades down here. It's hard enough to do for a year or 2 years, but that's a guy
who was tremendous.
And there's a handful of guys who are still that good.
And that's my greatest regret is the commitment of time. I don't make enough time for it. You have to do that. I tell you what reminded me of exactly what you just said was something that I said to Jeff on a previous podcast. I just recently, at age 56, caught my first tarpon on fly.
56? That's how old you are already?
That's how old I am.
How old were you when we met? Were you 20-something?
I was 21
Jesus
or 22.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So at any rate,
and Jeff, how old were you when I first saw you? Were you a teenager probably, right?
I don't even think I was a teenager when I first saw you. I was probably 12, 13 years old.
That's unbelievable.
And I would watch you for a few different reasons. One, you hung out at Lauderdale Marina. Okay. I was always at Lauderdale Marina, whether I was on my bike or I was coming up in my little whaler. That was just kind of like my home base. And I can remember you as a teenager or 20 years old or whatever, and you would sit on the coolers there, and you'd wait for your afternoon trip or your second trip or whatever it was. I'd be rolling down there, and I would just watch. And the thing that...
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's tecovas.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
The thing that really stood out to me at that age was you had a Maverick already. And it was the only Maverick that I ever saw. It was the only flats boat that I ever saw, or at least the first ones that I ever saw. And I think I finally got enough nerve to talk to you. And I said, hey, that boat really works, doesn't it? And you kind of looked at me like, well, yeah. You know what I mean? But it was so long. It was so long ago. And you were the first person that made my brain put two and two together, saying, you know, I could be a fishing guide. I could make it happen, and I can make it happen right here in Fort Lauderdale. Now, is that the first place you started guiding, was right downtown in Port Everglades?
Well, first of all, to Norm's point about the dedicating time to things,
yeah.
I think anybody can be a guide, and that's the key to getting started is putting that
you
time
gotta
in.
You've got to put the time in.
You have to put yourself through school. Is right. What you're really doing.
Right.
I hated every second of school from first grade to the two or three years I spent at BCC floundering. I hated every second. I'm looking outside. I'm like, man, look at the visibility. We could be throwing it. You know, it drove a spike in me. I said, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to do what I'm going to do. Jeff, getting back to your question, the first places I started working were in Port Everglades in 1977. And I started guiding then. And we were also, because we lived in South Florida and because we were younger and driving didn't mean anything. When you're in your 20s, you could drive cross country and, you know, do it almost overnight and still have enough energy. But we would also go to Charcoalski, Flamingo, Biscayne Bay, Isla Mirada, the Lower Keys. Mm-hmm. Spent a great deal of time in the Lower Keys too. So, yeah, we started in Port Everglades. Yes.
But you also fished the wintertime.
Palm Beach.
In Palm Beach.
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, that was a great fishery. Still is. They had an outfall there, too. They had a
hot water canal.
They did have... Well, it was a boil. They called it the boil by Peanut Island there.
Okay.
And it was full of big jacks. And, of course, the inlet was tremendous. And we fished a little bit north of Peanut Island. We fished by Munyon Island. We could sight fish... Mm-hmm. We could sight fish reds and some snook and some black drum up on the flats near Munyon Island. I understand there's a buddy of mine that lives up there who's a Coors distributor, Eddie Berger, and Eddie tells me that he's catching bonefish there by Munyon Island in the spring, summer, and fall on the inside in the intercoastal.
Wow.
Regularly. He doesn't just catch them once in a while. Like, he'll catch four or five in a day.
It can't possibly be that way on the weekend, though, because there's so many sandbar.
Yeah, but you say that, but think of Sands Cut or Stiltville on the weekend, and there's just as many people going by those places, and we still catch bonefish there, even in Isla Mirada. You know, some of the best places to bonefish here are right next to thoroughfares,
because
that's where the flow is, that's where the you know, the nutrients and the right grass and the right stuff in the grass is. So it doesn't the fish are going to be here while we're here and after we leave. They have to be back to what you said before. Those places that they keep returning to, they keep returning there.
Yeah, doesn't matter thank whether God. Or not you're there.
No, thank God they keep returning. We wouldn't be able to make a living if they didn't.
Right. Now, when you started in guiding out of Fort Lauderdale, were there guys that you could look at the way I was able to look at you?
There was two guys that really fished. Regularly back in the intercoastal back then. One of them fished the inlet and the discharge canal a little bit, and I don't know his name. It was the Dotty Red, and I'm going way back, and if you can come up. See, this is where we
this
need
is
your
where
pop.
Dad,
this is where we need.
Dad caught his first tarpon with that guy.
He would know in 1 second
who
he is. And the other guy was Bill Mann. Bill Mann had... Nope. An aqua sport called the Tarpon Hunter, and he docked it back at Lagomar East on Lake Mayan back there. And he would go in the discharge canal, and he would drift shrimp through there. His whole deal was put the shrimp out, drift out, and then drift out in the intercoastal, come back and drift out. But you ask if there was someone that I could look at. I mean, I looked at everybody and watched everybody and tried to learn as much as I could, but... Really, in the intercoastal back then, that was the only people that were fishing. You had some people that would fish occasionally back in the river. You heard all the stories about, like you said, Marina Bay and back in there. But nobody really, there was nobody doing it for a living, except for Bill Mann was doing it, and that was really just seasonal. I didn't see him much in the summer. I don't know that he lived there in the summer. But he was kind of a quiet guy, and then all of a sudden he just wasn't around anymore. I don't know if he passed.
I think Kenny Collette also.
Kenny Collette did a little
A little bit of guiding there.
Kenny worked at Harbor Bait and Tackle.
Yes, he did.
He worked with Roger Wise. And yep. Back when they had the bait shop was on that very first canal by 17th Street.
That was my first custom fishing rod.
Oh, my God.
Built by Harbor Bait and Tackle.
My first one was a Bill Boyd custom rod.
Yeah.
And it's funny. I used to net mullet for Harbor Bait and Tackle, for Carl's Bait and Tackle. They bought dead silver mullet to make rigged baits with,
mm-hmm.
and I sold live mullet to the whole A dock at Bahiamar, the Three T's, Lazy Bones, what was the other, Robin Song,
right. Happy Day Today,
of course, yeah. Tommy Zach, right? Yep. That was Tommy Zach's boat. But I'm going way back.
I remember several of those boats.
Yep.
Yeah, the Bahiamar, year before last, they took the A-Dock, what I call the University of Fishing, and they got rid of it.
Oh, no, they didn't.
Yeah, it's
yes,
gone.
They did.
No.
And it was really hard. There wasn't a lot of us that felt that way, but the ones that can remember and understand what that dock, who came from there, what happened there, the good, the bad, the evil, everything about A-Dock, and there was so much, I don't know how to say it, say fishing spirit there.
Sure.
History is right.
When they ripped that thing apart, I took my boat down there, and I just wanted to see if the tarpon were still hanging around that, where the charter boats were, and I just wanted to see what it felt like. And there was this empty feeling in my heart, because I can never remember it not being there. And I can never remember not being one of my stops, whether I was on my bicycle, whether I was on my skiff, all the way up until picking up my clients from Harbor Beach. I'd have them walk over there, and I'd pick them up at the end of the dock there.
Hmm.
And now when you drive by, I can still see the boats, even though they're not there, and it's all construction now.
Huh.
Yeah.
My father used to drive to Bahiamar in the afternoon with 2 six-packs of beer, and he would drive there with my mother, and they were, this is what he said, quote, dating. So I'll tell you more about that in a second. But this was before the 7 mile bridge catwalk. Anyway, so they would drive there, and they would give a 6-pack of beer to one of the guys and take 3 or 4 Bonitas from them. You know how they used to hang the fish up on the nails?
Yeah, yeah.
And of course, back then there was a sailfish on every, you know, there was dolphin, everything there, wahoo, kingfish. But they would get the Bonitas in exchange for a 6-pack of beer. And Dad would go to Harbor Beach that you just mentioned before any of those homes were built there. There was a beach and some of the iron seawall, and they would drive there and they would shark fish with rope and chain and tie it to the bumper of the car. And this is going way back before those homes were there. This is 50s, way back.
Yeah.
And they caught some fish in there that were unbelievable. And they would go on the limbs of the Australian pines, put the thing. And Dad's favorite story was one night they were, as he said, sitting in the car innocently, for sure, in the middle of the night. And they got a bite, and it took the branch off of the Australian pine, a major branch off of Australian pine, and busted at the bumper. And he said all you could see in the moonlight was the branch going out the inlet,
the
intercoastal,
like the Jaws scene.
Yeah. This is pre-Jaws, but there's
trust
some...
me. Swim,
oh,
swim, Charlie, swim. Don't look back, Charlie.
There's some major animals still to this day in the port. Well, I mean, talk to Zach Routman. He fishes right around the inlet a lot and does really well in there. He's been catching some massive bull sharks there.
Oh, yeah. Well, the funny thing about that story that you just told, in the 50s, that was less than 10 years removed from when they filled in the original New River Inlet.
Which was at Bahiamar.
Which was just south of Bahiamar.
That's correct.
Okay. And I see these old historic photos, and it's just amazing how...
Can you remember that?
No, I do not remember the inlet being there. No. Nope.
Okay. Yeah, because
that might be a little before your time. I think it was before I was.
Yeah, I saw some pictures and stuff, and people ask me, and I'm like, no, I don't.
No.
I remember the old rocks.
There's some little rocks we used to catch a ton of snooks at when we were kids that people said that was the old inlet.
Right, the markers for that's correct.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that, I don't know, Fort Lauderdale, as much as they dredge it, as many ships as they bring in there and turning on and off the hot water canal and dumping the sewage in the water and dumping all the trash in the water, we still crush the tarpon.
It's just amazing.
It is amazing. And I thank God for it every day that we still have something left. Now, way back when, okay, did you have any inclination what, not just Fort Lauderdale, but all of South Florida was going to turn into? Did you have a vision? Because I damn sure didn't, and it caught me. I didn't get it till I was probably 45.
No. I was born in Broward General Hospital, and we lived in Melrose Park until 1974, 75, about 1975. And we left there to move out west. We thought that Plantation was way the hell out west.
It was.
And it was back then. That's right. Broward Boulevard used to end at 441.
Once
upon a time. So then after that, I moved out to Davie. And Davie was at the edge of the Everglades. And, of course, now Weston, you know, has superseded.
Right.
You know,
I remember the cow pastures at Broward and University.
Broward Mall was a cow pasture.
Yep. That was
that's
it.
Right.
It was a cow pasture.
I remember that. And that's not really that long ago.
No, it wasn't. I was in high school.
I can see in my mind driving by on University and looking over at the cows.
I was in high school.
Oh, my God.
Mm-hmm.
No, I did not. I did not foresee that coming. My parents got the hell out of Broward County in 1980. 85, 86, and went up to Port St. Lucie. And Dad is still there. At 96, Dad is still there.
That's awesome.
But we, in Melrose Park in the 60s, I think I told Norm this. If I didn't, I told your dad, and he got a kick out of it. In the 60s, when in Fort Lauderdale, the entire city of Fort Lauderdale, when somebody moved in or moved out, there was an entire paragraph in the paper about them. Where they came from, how many people were in the family.
You must have told that story to my father because I'd never heard that. That's amazing.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. And I remember reading those little paragraphs. I remember someone would come into our neighborhood and Dad would say, oh, you know, we got a new guy off of Dayton Circle.
Huh.
You know, new family. Let's read about him. And there it was. You could read about it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
No, I did not see anything like that happening. And it's caught up to us in the Keys. You know, I moved down here to have a year-round multiple species fishery.
Right.
We can do stuff here all year long. We can't do tarpon, bonefish, and permit every day, but the days we can't, we can do trout and redfish and snook and mackerel and sharks and.
There's always something here.
There's always something.
Always.
Marcy, you'd get a kick out of this. Marcy and I sat down a couple of years ago and on a piece of paper, we made a list of fish species. We came up with 37 species that are at our dock. that's the fish that we have seen at our dock.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. The so when you moved down here, did you do that because of your personal will for fishing, or was it more of a business decision, or was it blind luck?
No, it wasn't luck. It was rather calculated.
Okay.
I always wanted to be down here at least part of the year. And as soon as I got my driver's license in the 70s, I spent at least a few months of the year down here working. I would rent a place. We would fish Alamorada in the Lower Keys. I spent part of the year in the Lower Keys, part of the year here. And then, of course, in the interim, we could drive back and forth from Broward to Biscayne Bay. It was only a 45-minute drive.
Right.
Well, that was before Dade County exploded as well, and the traffic got to where it is now. But it was very calculated because, again, we needed, as the fishing in Broward became less dependable, you said they're still there. I'm glad to hear that. But it's not, nothing is like it was back then, of course, and you can't be sad anywhere. About it. You can't, right. You can't be sad about it though, because then you would do something harmful to yourself if you're going to get that depressed about how it used to be.
Like run dinner boats in Miami.
Well, we still have the water and we can still make a living from it.
Yeah,
right. You can still do something. Yeah. But no, it was a calculated move to come down here and also, you know, to get into the tournament scene and just expand your, you know, expand business.
So you started down here part-time. When did you move here permanently?
1999.
It was 1999. Mm-hmm. Okay. And, you know, we were talking about this on the way down about part-time guides. And how has that changed from when you were doing it?
Well, put it this way, because, all right, so when you came here, right, I'm sure, you know, the guides weren't, like, super happy. Like, oh, we got a guy from Fort Lauderdale now fishing with us.
They hated us.
Right.
Yeah.
They called us the effing Fort Lauderdale trailer guides. They hated us.
Right.
And there was John Donnell, Bob Branham, Rick Rubel, Kenny Collette.
Yeah.
That was the group that came down here. And then when we started fishing the tournaments, then they really, really hated us. I've said this before. We had, back during the time of no caller ID and answering machine, I had death threats on my phone in Davie. We had tires slashed at Lorelei. You know, we went through the old West days here.
Right. And because you went through that, right, in today's day and age, where you see these guides coming in from Montana and Colorado and Wyoming, and they come down here and they fish for tarpon 3 months out of the year, what's your perspective on that? How does that...
The jet set guys.
Because from Fort Lauderdale, looking at it as a tarpon guide, I think to myself, okay, we have guides coming from out of state that are taking money from people that are out of state, that are giving it now to corporations that are public or people from out of state. And I look and I think to myself, is this good for anybody? Or is just this a new way to exploit the resources that we've already exploited?
That is the answer to that would take another hour to answer it properly and with the appropriate emotions. But for the most part, we fish tarpon so many different ways here that I respect someone who comes down and fly fishes and is really, really good and has honed that skill, because it's very difficult to do that. It's extremely difficult to do that for a whole season. It's a lot of work. It's a chessboard. It's positioning. You have to be at places before other people get there. You have to anticipate other people's moves to get your next spot. Generally, when you fly fish tarpon on Alamorada in season, you have time for two moves during the day. Your first spot, and then you better get to your second spot early in the tide to make sure you have it so you can keep someone out of there so you can have those fish to fish. In the backcountry, it's a little easier to fish back there. You can fish more spots, but that fishery isn't the same either. That fishery has deteriorated over the last 20 years, particularly over the last five or six. So most of our tarpon fly fishery is on the ocean side here. Mm-hmm. So it has bundled people closer together. The etiquette has suffered. The etiquette has eroded, and I do not fish the tarpon fly tournaments anymore. And because I fished them for so long, I was fortunate enough to be on the rules committee of all three at any given time, the Gold Cup and the Holly and the Golden Fly. And every single day in every single one of those tournaments, there was friction. There was a rules violation. There was a complaint. And I don't want to be a part of, I respect that group, but I don't want to be a part of that part of it. I want to go fishing and still enjoy it. And I'll play the chess game, you know, not being in the tournaments too, not being in the tournaments, you still have to play that game if you want to fly fish tarpon. But I'm going to be courteous and overly courteous, because I don't want to be part of those confrontations. And if someone, Jimmy Albright probably summed it up best years ago. I said to Jimmy, I got to know him a little bit many years ago, and you were talking about, you know, people that you looked up to years ago. That's one of the guys that I did for sure, and so did many others.
Oh, yeah.
But I said, Jimmy, what do you do when somebody just cuts your balls off and gets right in front of you on a spot? And he said, I don't yell. He said, I just go up to him, and I say, you know, when there's an altercation between cars, the car that's parked in the parking lot usually isn't at fault. And he said that usually disarms somebody right away. And he said, if it goes to the next level, he said, I'll gladly go to the next level after that. But I don't want any confrontations. I want to be courteous, but I also want my space to fish in.
Right.
And you have to get that. You have to play that chess game to do it.
Yeah, but there's got to be one guy, whether you're fishing a tournament or you're just fishing, you know, a customer, any given day when you see him coming from a half mile away, there's got to be one guy that just gets your ass puckered and you're just ready to just tell this guy, who's that guy for you? Come on.
You want me to drop a name?
Absolutely.
I can't.
There's got to be one guy that just pisses you off more than life itself.
I will carefully navigate on the perimeter of this question, and there's a handful of those guys.
Yes.
There's a handful. I won't drop specific names, but I always felt that.
Give us initials.
No, I always felt that if they're making me that pissed off, that's the way they have to feel about themselves all the time.
I can't get this guy to say it.
I can't.
I knew he wouldn't.
And you know what? If you talk to anybody else down here or any 10 tarpon fly guides especially, they all know who those folks
absolutely
are.
Absolutely.
They know. And it's more the private guy who has his own boat that tries to go out and squeeze in somewhere. That's mm-hmm. our biggest issue. It's mm-hmm. not jet skis.
Right.
It's not recreational yeah. boats. It's the private guy who has just as much right to fish
right.
where we fish.
So it's more of a type of a...
It's more of a... Right, it's more a demographic.
Yeah, demographic. If you wanted to. That's the word for it.
So that guy, I don't know if it's right or wrong to do that, to go out with a guide and then go to his spots. I only know that I wouldn't do that. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I just would not do that.
Right. And you know, that's the thing that I've seen even in Fort Lauderdale is just a literal explosion of what we call fishing booker guides who you know, a lot of them are either up and comers or they're retirees that just want something to do, so they go, you know, they go buy a boat and they put up a listing on Fishing Booker, and there they are.
Yeah.
And those are just, I don't know, those are just the worst kinds of...
Well, let me use this as a segue, because it was on my list of questions to ask.
But by the way, that list is very intimidating. I don't know what the hell's going to fly out of their neck, so go ahead.
No, like, it's just, you know, like I was fortunate enough. My dad was in the business. I grew up on the sport fishing boats. And I had a little bit of a nucleus of people that would hire me to run their boats or to fish with them or to be a mate. And then as my inshore business started to take off, I was very fortunate to be able to take advantage of YouTube at a very young birthing of the social media thing, which totally blew up for me. But way back when, starting so early, how did you market yourself? And what was the best way to market yourself back in the late 70s, early 80s as an inshore guide? Because you didn't get the hotels to say, hey, what do they call it, deep sea fishing or whatever. It was a niche in fishing that wasn't commonly known. And it always was mind-boggling to me that you guys could stay busy.
Well, you can't beat a satisfied guy that walks off the boat. There's no matter what era we live in, that is irreplaceable. And I take a lot of shit from some of my cohorts here, good-natured poking about not having a website and this and that. And you can't buy that kind of advertising. When somebody tells 10 other people or tells other people in his town, that is, you cannot put a price tag on that. You could sit down and figure out the trips you get from it, but you can't. The first big giant thing that happened was in the Sun Sentinel years ago, Craig Davis called me, and he was, I believe he was the sports writer after Oz Keggy. Mm-hmm. And Craig Davis called and said, you know, would it be okay if we, he was so nice and he did a story and then I, you know, I couldn't even keep up for that year. I couldn't keep up with the people that it came out from a simple, wonderful article in the Sun Sentinel.
Well, but you did, you were a very prolific outdoor writer yourself. Tell us a little bit about that.
I started doing work for Florida Sportsman a long time ago and then worked for several other magazines around that time simultaneous and still do some things here and there, but was on the masthead at Florida Sportsman for a while. And that's another, Vic Dunaway and Carl Wickstrom, both of those guys, you know, I mean, monsters in our industry.
Oh, yeah.
I had so much respect for both of them.
I'll never forget, this is a quick story. We were on a flat, Dad and I were fishing on a flat with Mark down in Biscayne Bay, and the tide had just turned. And there was a tide line that was running in this particular spot. And I remembered from many years ago, previously, about tide line permits that would feed along the tide lines. And I started quoting from that article because it sunk in really hard with me. I was like, Mark, we're going to have a shot at permit on this tide line, aren't we? He goes, yeah. And I started quoting from that article. He says, yeah. He says, I wrote that article, you know.
Back when people used to read.
Right, when there were magazines. Yeah. I mean, sadly, have you seen Florida Sportsman magazine lately?
Yeah, it's this thing.
It's a brochure thick.
Yeah.
And I'm so sorry to see that because Florida Sportsman was a huge part of my life. I couldn't wait to get it, couldn't wait to read it. And it was the size of a phone book.
Right.
And now it's so sad to see that. I hope it explodes. I just hope it re-explodes and really miss that magazine.
There's some that, you know, it's strange how some of it is really still very popular and some of it has waned just a little bit. Like Marlin Magazine, for example, is as big as it's ever been. There's other publications that are just huge. And I don't understand. I think it had a lot to do with when the economy took a dump in 2008. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of these publications, and plus the emergence of social media.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I don't think they've quite grown with that. They had a very good online presence with their chat rooms. I remember that was very popular, but then it just kind of died after that.
That was the beginning and the end for Florida Sportsman was the fishing forums. Although they were able to start probably the biggest and the baddest fishing forum at the beginning.
Yeah.
But little did they know that it was going to cannibalize on their actual publication because, especially with the younger kids, is they want short, quick info. So if they can get Mark's fishing report, they'll never read the article about Mark or what he was fishing or why or anything like that. All they want to do is get that short information.
Yeah, but they don't want to do their due diligence anymore.
Which,
but,
like I said, was the beginning of the end.
So there's a great point, Norm, because it's like these people that get injections to have forearms and pecs. Yeah, that's great. It looks good. But the guy that built himself up is the guy that has the...
Right.
He's the guy.
Yep.
And you have that now. You have people with the GPS and they watch this and they watch that and they go on WindGuru and everybody's a weatherman now.
You know? Of course.
Especially
except us.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And they go out and they know exactly where they're going to go. They got a number from somebody, a GPS number, and that's the guy that's injecting. That ain't the guy that learned
artificial.
Why you have to be there and when you have to be there. That's the guy. And there's not a lot of those guys. There's not a lot of those guys anymore.
Okay, and you know, to that point, you know, one of the most... If you're listening to this podcast and you've never fished with Mark Croca, one of the most remarkable takeaways from a day fishing with Mark will be how he knows when you have to be at a certain location and what he calls the window of opportunity. And he'll often refer to that several times during the trip. Our window of opportunity at this location is beginning to wane, or we're going to have a longer window at this. And what he's referring to is the tides in relationship to spots. But what's remarkable about fishing with you is that you are an encyclopedia of knowledge, and you'll explain why things happen the way they do at this particular spot. And I think that's the difference between a guide and a charter captain.
Well, it's like you both were saying earlier, though, the fish continue to do the same things at the same places. And Hank Brown said something. He had a great quote one day years ago. And I said, man, I can't find them. I can't find the permit in that zip code anymore. He said, well, think about the same thing that happened when they did something different last time. He said, they're going to do the same thing different again. And I it was kind of a jumble of words, but he was right. When they do something different, it's the same thing they did different the last time you weren't expecting it. Yeah. They're repetitive in their behavior, and thank God they are. We could never plug into it if they weren't.
Oh, I mean, I remember trips. We staked out on a flat. We were chumming the spot, and Mark says, the bonefish are going to come from right to left at 10 feet. 10 feet is a shot. And he'd make you practice that cast until you got it right. And sure enough, at a certain point, the bonefish, there's three bonefish that come from right to left, and they stop right on your chum. And it's like, how did you know that was going to happen?
But it's the same thing. It's because they do the same thing all the time. Yeah. I got to, the first time I met Bill Curtis was at the ramp at Crandon in the 70s. And he stopped and talked. He was a little bit grumpy, but I think he appreciated young people who were interested in the fishery. Oh, you know, geez, you should have been here, you know, 10 years ago when the fishing was good. I'm like, holy shit, the fishing's pretty good now. He said he would take a can of cat food out on Stiltsville and go to a white spot and poke holes in it with an ice pick and throw the can of cat food on the white spot. And he said the bonefish would come for 2 or 3 hours. And he said, man, once in a while we'd have to get another can of cat food and poke holes in that one too. You know, cat food. And you know, we didn't know it was going to get so sophisticated that it had to be, you know, a mounding handful of fresh cut live shrimp, you know, pea-sized corn kernel size.
I remember that.
So yep. That they wouldn't get full and you have to throw it at a perfect spot on the white spot and you got to line everything up. You know, it just gets more and more complicated as time goes on. But cat food, yeah. Just unbelievable.
And do you still fish the bay anymore?
I do.
Do you?
I do. I've got a shot at Homestead Bayfront Park. When I put in at Homestead Bayfront, I'm still only 15 minutes away from Soldiers and, you know, the whole circuit there.
Wow.
But I wanted the audience to hear you say what you saw in the old days, the first time you saw the real mullet run come down the beach.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Because what they call the mullet run now, okay, we can call it a mullet run simply because, but the mullet run in the old days was a little different. How did you see it?
My dad took me to the South Jetty at Port Everglades. We also went to Anglin's Pier and Dania Pier, and you could stand in any of those places, and it was a dark stripe that was 100 feet wide along the beach, as far as you could see both ways, and every 150 feet or 200 feet, there was a massive shower of either tarpon or black tips or whatever the hell else was under that much bait back then. And we didn't need a cast net.
No.
You could throw, yeah. And I remember buying these things at Carl's Bait and Tackle, the treble hook with the lead in the middle of it. We called them snatch hooks or snag hooks.
Three-eyed shrimp.
And yeah, that's right. And we'd throw that out and snag our mullet and just put them right back out on whatever we snagged them on, and that's how we fished.
Yeah.
There were not thousands of mullet, there weren't millions, there was probably billions.
Yeah.
Just billions. And I remember that black stripe. I remember the perspective looking down at that from peers. And of course, when you're young, heights are much exaggerated in your memory. It was like you're standing on a high rise looking down and seeing all those. I mean, as a kid, it's spectacular. Not, you're a young boy. It just blows your mind.
Not anymore at Anglin's. Anglin's is gone.
Anglin's Pier is gone.
Yeah, storm gone. Ripped it up, storm. And they never fixed it back up again.
Oh, my goodness.
Gone. Yeah, the piers. And that's kind of normal. We're seeing any place that had anything to do with fishing, from Palm Beach to Miami, is slowly fading. For instance, there's that pier is gone. There was no public outreach saying, come on, fix the pier. We need that. Nah. It's good for the kids. It's good for this. It's good for that. Or when they were going to throw the people off the beach where they couldn't fish, there was no public outrage. Thank God Carl Ball and Kantner tipped everybody off, or we were able to rally. Because otherwise, you know, they would have closed down the beach. And in this day and age, because people don't see things like the mullet run, because their dads can't take them to the pier and take home dinner,
yeah,
people are losing, I shouldn't say losing perspective. They have never no have perspective.
It. They don't have it.
You know, so I always love to ask, you know, guys that really saw the mullet run. Now, to me, mullet are the chicken of the ocean. There is no bait that I would rather have, whether I'm fishing for marlin, whether I'm fishing for sailfish, whether I'm fishing for snooks, or I'm fishing for tarpon, is the old mullet. And I learned that, Mark, from watching you. Mm. No, because you would sit at a few different corners on the intercoastal, and your mullets would be sitting back there, or you'd sit in the hot water canal, and your mullets are sitting back there. And amongst everybody else that was fishing with the big mullets, I never knew any different. So I grew up thinking that everybody in the world was fishing with mullets. But it was kind of a Southeast Florida thing.
It is. And in Fort Lauderdale, if you were talking about Zach Rotman before, Zach has figured out the path of the mullets inside Fort Lauderdale, and that is the key to success of fishing there. If you can figure the mullet out year-round, and sometimes it's hard to get a dozen mullet. It's very difficult.
Bingo.
He just said it.
You do know that's one of the phrases that we've coined over the years.
What's that?
Can you get a dozen?
Yeah.
You have to wake up every morning and you have to look yourself in the mirror and you have to ask yourself, can I not get a dozen?
Well, when you talked about sitting at Lauderdale Marina, sitting around waiting, in Fort Lauderdale, because of time of year and tide and current weather conditions, sometimes the window to get the mullet that you needed to fish your trip with was right at dawn, and the trip might not be till 3 o'clock.
Yep.
And you had to be there and you had to get them so you could have them. Sometimes it was at 9 o'clock, sometimes it was at noon, but you had to be there and you had to make sure that you had that, because that was the foundation of your day of fishing in Fort Lauderdale, was having those mullet. And they provided so many great, great scenes over the years of, you know, getting crashed behind the boat. But now here's something interesting. In the Keys, in Alamorada, we go get mullet, and the dead mullet on bottom here is 1,000 times more effective than the live mullet in most cases. We use in March, April, May, and sometimes going into the first couple weeks of June, we fish more dead baits on bottom than we do live mullet.
Do you think that's because the fish are conditioned because of all the carcassing?
No. I think what's happened is the tarpon here, and if you remember the last time we fished, the tarpon here bite from midnight to about 5:30 a.m.
Yep.
And then they stop.
That's it.
And they're not the same after the first little shimmer of light. They're not the same. They can turn off at 6 o'clock, 6:05, 6:10. Now if it's crappy out and drizzly, sometimes that'll last longer. But we use the crabs and the pinfish and sometimes pilchards and sometimes live mullet in the dark or at dusk. They'll do it at dusk a little bit. They'll bust them. But once the sun comes out here, they're down on the bottom and they're so used to the hours that everybody fishes here. And that's how the carcassers came to be. The carcassers don't have to go out at dawn or dusk. They can go out in the middle of the day and drop all their shit behind the boat and, you know, make a scene literally and figuratively and catch a fish. But that's funny. Can you go get a dozen? That's and not only that, it's not just getting mullet. You're thinking about the fishery that day, and you're thinking of a specific size mullet
that
you may need for that day. Yeah, maybe you can go get, you know, a 22-inch black mullet somewhere up the river, but that's maybe not what you want to use for bait. You may need a 6-inch silver for something that's on your mind. So that's further complicates the matter.
Yeah.
Well, you know,
I'm sorry, I forgot one more thing. The 7-foot net limit in Broward.
Yeah.
The more, you know, more handicapping.
Well, you know, I listened to that podcast you did with Andy, and you were talking about the 7-foot net and the restrictions, and we're only allowed to use a 7-foot net. But I got to tell you, and maybe it wasn't like that when you were fishing, but the mullet are so thin nowadays. Like you're throwing at mullet that are racing by the boat like a bonefish.
Oh my goodness, yes.
So to throw a 6 or a 7 footer, kind of like Spider-Man throws out his web real quick, is the ticket. It's not like there's a 1,000 mullets sitting there where I can throw a 10-footer and pancake them and get them all. I mean, we're getting onesie, twosie, threesies at a time.
Yeah.
So that 7-foot net that can come out, you can load it quick and it can come out quick, is a better tool than, say, a 10-footer.
For sure. It's netting mullet is an athletic event. It should be in the Olympics. I'm serious.
Ah, yes.
My God. Oh, yeah. Oh, rate the opening, rate the distance, the accuracy. Yeah, you know. Yeah. For sure.
And you know the German judge is always going to be tough on you.
the art of catching mullet, no bones about it, is the key for inshore fishermen from, let's call it, Palm Beach to Crandon.
There's no doubt. And down here, too. Throw it in down here. You know, we have two full-time, for 3 months of the year, we have two full-time guys here that net mullet for all the charter boats,
yep,
for all the bay boats and the skiffs.
I used to buy mullets from them.
Yeah,
that's
because I had a boat that I couldn't net mullet with.
Well, here's the problem: those guys don't go in the park. They don't. They didn't. None of them have their park license, so they net here and they spend a great deal of time in our canals, mm-hmm, right here behind the house.
Yeah.
So go try to get. You're talking about go get a dozen mullet. At the end of the day, when you're done fishing, when those guys have been throwing their net all day long from dawn till, you know, getting ready for the afternoon trips, the guys to go out for shift number two, go try to get a mullet around here. You said they come by like bonefish. Here they come by like wahoo. It is. You have to be able to throw that net. You have to throw your net 25 feet and open it reasonably well and do it
and
pretty damn quick.
Yeah. And that's a fast sinking net too. So that's a heavy net.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is.
Yeah.
That's why you guys are in better shape than I am.
Well, it's what you have to do. You just have to do that to get them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like, I mean, I always put everything in the perspective of sports. In most sports, like I grew up playing football, you know, there was a system. If you practiced that system and you refined your game, you could overcome size, you could overcome speed, you could overcome a lot by technique and practice. And people think that fishing is not like that.
No.
And it's all about that. It's practice, practice, practice. It could be the simplest thing, like in basketball. You know, these guys that are getting paid millions of dollars, they get up every morning, they go to the free-throw line, and they start practicing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I'm 54 years old now, and I'm practicing still.
Oh, yeah.
And the day you quit that practice, you will hurt yourself, and you'll fall down that ladder one step, but surely you will come back down that ladder.
George Wood, who we just lost, unfortunately.
No.
He was one of, yeah, George Wood passed away this year. Yes. George was a very underrated guide here. He really
not
knew.
Unless you were talking to George.
Well, that's true. That's true. But you know what? If you can walk the walk, you can talk the talk.
And he
Go
did.
Ahead and talk.
And he did.
And he did. Correct. Yeah. He was very, very good at a lot of different kinds of fishing around Isla Mirada, but he used to talk about that. He said, if you're not moving forward, you're moving backward. He said, I'm always trying to learn more and get better and do this a better way. I'm always trying to get better. And he was right. He was right. And as competitive as Isla Mirada is, you can't lay back. You can't sit back and say, hey, I know enough, because you don't.
No.
You don't know enough, and you never will. Nobody ever will. We practice all the time. You know, I had my I have, you know, I don't have them right now. I ordered them, but I have the rings out on the canal. We practice casting all the time. I still practice with my cast net.
And that's the thing. I mean, I got my kid just came to live with me at 19 years old, and I've got to show him. You know, when he was 5 years old, I taught him how to throw with a Zebco 202,
which we all started.
Everybody. And I wanted him to start the same way I did, and so I went out and I got him a Zebco 202 in 2000, and I think it was 4 or 5. When he was just old enough to stand and have a modicum of hand-eye coordination. Mm-hmm. And I put one in his hand with a rubber core sinker, and I taught him how to do that. And he could fire that thing across the lot. And, I mean, he was good at it. But now at 19, you know, we've had some time pass between us, and I want him to learn how to throw with a spinning with spin gear. Mm-hmm. And so I got to start that all over again.
He'll do it.
Yeah, and he will.
But George Wood used to say, son, this is a sport. This is not fishing. This is a sport like any other sport. Exactly what you said.
Oh, yeah.
Things are moving. I'm moving. I'm moving the boat. Your eyes are your coordination. He said, it's a sport.
Yeah. Have you ever noticed that most golfers, really good golfers, are also very good fly fishermen?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
For the same reason.
Hand-eye, too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, they got the hand-eye coordination, you got the practice element, but I would take it a lot further than just golfers. I think people that understand athletics and understand the process it takes to be an athlete, then fish, and it's easier for them to say, hey, this is what you have to do. You have to dedicate yourself. You have to put in the time. You have to put in the practice. You have to surround yourself with people that are the best.
Yeah.
And then, just like in any other sport, if you don't do that, you are never going to be the best. With as much talent as you may have, without that, that is your missing link.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Mark, one thing that has always amazed me about you about – you know, Mark's modest, but he's probably the winningest backcountry tournament guide in the Keys, and at least in recent history that I know of. Certainly one of the top echelon guides, and it's one of the reasons we came down here. But Mark's also you fly under the radar. You don't have websites, and you don't have the TV shows, and you don't do the big social media thing. And tell us a little bit more about that part of your life and why is it that you do that? Because you could easily get a fishing show. You could easily, be one of these big quote unquote celebrities.
If that ever comes, it'll be great. If it doesn't come, it really doesn't make any difference. My favorite thing to do is to go fishing, and that's all I want to do. I don't have anything against social media. I think it's great if someone figures that out and can make a business model and go about their life that way. That's great. I would much rather stay one-on-one with people and develop the friendships and stay low-key and simple and non-complex. I just don't – if I can be practice casting in the backyard, why would I want to be on Facebook? You know, that's just the way I look at it. Mm-hmm. And Marcy will sometimes give me a little bit of a hard time about maybe having a bigger presence and getting more in tune with technology. But someday, I mean, when it's necessary – I still haven't texted. I don't know how to text. and I know that's uncommon now, but I just don't want to get into that. I want to be more hands-on with everything. I don't want to look at things on the computer. I want to be doing them. I don't want to send pictures out to everyone about what I've been doing. I want to get onto the next picture someone's going to take.
Right.
I want to continue to move forward and continue to improve. And I always felt when you got into too much into that, that your foot is off the gas pedal for a minute, and I don't want to do that.
Well, and it's kind of like fishing. When you do that, your focus has to be on that. Therefore, your focus isn't on what makes you tick, which is the fishing itself. So, yeah, it's normal. See, I think social media is just fine for all the people that knew what it was like before social media.
Mm-hmm.
Where I think social media is not fine is, like, my daughter doesn't know what life was before social media. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So for them, it's got to be so much harder. You know what I mean? To kind of navigate through it and understand what it's good for, what it's not good for, and that kind of thing. But social media is definitely a double-edged sword. It's done some really great things, and it's done some really bad things. But I think all change has that same element to it. And it's what you do with what's given to you is what makes the difference.
Agreed.
Oh, yeah.
And Mark, what you've done in the fishing world is just phenomenal. And it's going to live on because you can't duplicate it and you can't replicate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ah, yeah, there's no two ways.
Well, the social media thing is when I get somebody, a 12-year-old or 10-year-old, 14-year-old, young man or woman in the boat, and we go out in the morning in the dark, and we get to the first spot, and all you can hear is tarpon popping or snook popping, and they're sitting in the corner texting. I can't understand. I would rip my arm off at their age to be in that position and donate a finger, you know, and then their head is down. And I do not understand.
They're missing so much.
The world is out here. The world isn't down here in the corner.
Yeah. On your thumbs.
It's not, just not that much. I know about it.
Yeah.
Not many things get me mad enough where you feel like your back, your head's starting to warm up or whatever. But when I bring out like an 18-year-old, right, and they lose a fish, and they're more pissed off because they didn't get their Instagram photo.
That's right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's what they're mad about. They're
that's
not
right.
mad that they screwed up.
That they lost the fish.
That they screwed right. up or the tackle broke or whatever. They're more mad about the Instagram. And it infuriates me to a degree where literally I can feel my temperature, you know, because I want that kid to realize the opportunity that just flashed in front of him was not an Instagram moment.
No.
Right.
You know, this is real life. This is what your dad brought you out here to experience.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But when that kid gets to be 45 years old, he'll be thinking about it a little differently than I was thinking about it. Just like Mark thinks about this stuff a little bit different than, say, we do.
Oh, yeah.
And the generations go on and go on and go on. But that's so, it's so important about these podcasts is they can get the most talented people that put themselves in the best position, and we can go on for hours and talk about this. But I'm going to wrap up the podcast because we've been doing this for an hour and 20 minutes.
Goodness gracious.
And I think we could go another hour and 20 minutes
easily.
And I got a feeling this may not be the last podcast that we do. But I can't thank you enough for having us. And for me, I'm going to talk about sitting down at Mark Kroger's house and doing a recording with him for the rest of my life, and I can't thank you enough.
Well, thank you guys for making the drive to be here. It's easy for us to be here. We live here. You had to get in the car and schlep all the way from Broward.
It was no schlep at all.
Pleasure having you, and come back for any reason, anytime.
We're gonna fish.
Well, yeah.
We're gonna fish.
Yeah, that was
that was my bad.
Yeah, whatever. This shit happens, but yeah, just for the audience to know that yes, we did end up booking the trip from that last podcast. And no, we didn't end up going fishing because...
I got booked. And I couldn't make it down early enough.
Too busy working to have fun. But anyway, great time. Thanks so much.
Thank you, guys. Thank you so much.
Run that dog.
Run that dog.
Did it.